You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Today, the State Department admitted that employees had snooped into the files of all the presidential candidates, including Hillary Clinton and John McCain. And that was a day after disclosing that three contract employees had tried to peek into the electronic passport records of Barack Obama. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice apologized today for the incidents, and Barack Obama said that he thinks that Congress should investigate the State Department snooping. Well, the unauthorized access was uncovered, and it's interesting in this case, by automatic security systems that monitor access to the files of very prominent individuals. But what if you're not one of those? What if you're like the rest of us? Our private we have data files in government files. We have data in bank records. What about the digital footprint, the information about yourself or your habits, information about all of our personal lives that we leave behind in cyberspace as we move about? You know, as we're going from place to place online, we make purchases, we explore the web. How much privacy do we have? How much should we expect? Well, joining me to talk about this are my next two guests. Daniel Weitzner is the W3C Technology and Society Policy Director and the co-director of the MIT CSAIL Decentralized Information Group at MIT. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Alessandro Acquisti is an assistant professor of information technology and public policy at the H. John Hynes III School of Public Policy and Management. That's at Carnegie Mellon University, and the co-editor of the book Digital Privacy, Theory, Technologies, and Practices. He joins us from Carnegie Mellon campus. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you first, Dr. Acquisti, what's your reaction to the announcements from the State Department about the snooping there?
Well, sadly, I'm not surprised, and it's a sad event, but it's just one of many episodes of privacy invasions we have been observing in the news recently or in the past months and years. As you observed a few seconds ago, what is important to note is that, yes, this particular event came to be known because the victims were famous people. But how many events are happening like that and we don't know about? This is a serious concern.
Dan Weitzner, do you agree?
I do. And I think the good news, in a way, and the lesson we should learn is that there are probably a lot of things that we could be doing on a broader basis across the web, across all different kinds of environments that hold sensitive information about us. There are a lot more things we could do to hold those institutions accountable and to give people a real sense that the privacy that they expect, you asked the question about expectations, mm-hmm. the privacy that we all expect can be protected much more carefully and with more effort.
Such as?
Well, I think that it's interesting that the way that the State Department caught this particular snooping incident, from what I understand about it, they look relatively carefully over time at the patterns of information usage, the patterns of information access in their database systems, and what apparently they found was that there were some unexplained events. Now, the federal government is under, as people probably know, a legal obligation to protect information it holds, and there are real consequences if they violate the federal privacy laws. There probably should be more consequences, but the government is an institution that tries to be careful about this. And I think that what we ought to do is we ought to expect institutions in the private sector, services on the web, for example, to put more effort into actually keeping track of whether information is being abused or not. We're long past the point, I think, especially with the web, where we can expect that privacy can be protected by keeping information secret, by locking it up and putting it behind sealed doors. What we have to recognize is that we're in an environment which is positive in many ways. People have all kinds of ways of using personal information, of exchanging it, of learning more things from it. So we've got to update both our laws and our technology to do a better job of monitoring how information is being used and catching those cases like this one where it's being abused.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Akiste, do you agree?
I do agree. I believe it's such a vast problem because we don't want to block the dissemination of personal information. As an economist, any economist would tell you that information creates more efficiency in the marketplace. However, there are costs and benefits associated with the revelation of personal data. And the problem is so vast that we need a co-regulative approach, the idea of combining technology, legal system, and market forces to try to balance these costs and benefits. Mm-hmm. And we can try to rely also on individual responsibility, on individual making the right decision. But the problem is that there are some issues which are beyond the control of the individual. To give you an example, when a couple of years ago, the Choice Point accident came to be known to the public, Choice Point had sold personal information, individual consumers to unknowingly to a criminal organization. Well, most of the people whose data had been breached didn't even know that Choice Point had mm-hmm. the data. In fact, I would assume that didn't even know what Choice Point was, yeah. which means that most of our data is actually outside our control. So there is only so much we can do to protect ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's more we need to take a ecosystem type of approach to the problem.
How much, Dr. I'm sorry, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to underscore the point that Alessandro made. It's really critical. We are at the point, if you compare, for example, the way that personal sensitive information is handled relative to the financial system, as an example. The flow of personal information in many ways is becoming like the flow of money in around the country and around the world, both because it has value as from an economic perspective, but also because it can mm-hmm. cause us harm. And if you look at the amount of energy and the amount of resources that we put into making sure that the financial system is fair, making sure that the right money ends up in the right places, that people's bank accounts don't get magically emptied, we put a huge amount of effort into that, and we look very carefully. We have measures. It's called accounting. We have measures of whether money has ended up where it ought to end up and whether the right people have it or not. And I think that as we come to rely more on the online exchange of personal information, we're going to have to get to that point. Again, we started off the Internet era in many ways with a kind of a libertarian attitude about personal privacy, and the questions were, what could an individual do to protect it? We talked a lot about using encryption and about using, you know, strong passwords and all those kind of things.
Right.
Those are still very important, but as information flows around, I think we're going to have to supplement that with a sense of what is our collective responsibility, what is the responsibility of institutions to make sure that information isn't abused.
We're just holding them responsible then, really, for whatever they collect.
Absolutely. And you know, it's instructive, again, to look at the State Department example. What the State Department was able to find was that some employees who weren't authorized to look at data, or who you wouldn't expect to look at the same data over and over again in the course of a couple days, they spotted that kind of anomaly, and they were able to take action based on that. I think that what we're going to have to do in computer science research and in information systems research is get better and better at characterizing not just who access information, but how is it used? Can we tell the difference between, for example, looking at passenger records of an airplane in order to spot terrorists, which we probably all want to do, versus looking at those same records to figure out whether there's someone on the plane who is late with her parking tickets and should be picked up at the airport. So we have to get better at discriminating different kinds of uses. And on the legal side, on the kind of societal level, come to some agreements about what we think are acceptable uses of personal information and what are unacceptable ones, and then go after making sure that people are accountable for those kinds of breaches.
Mm-hmm. Alexander, what is to keep a company from doing these bad things that we're talking about? Is it not legal for them to take the data and mine it and do things with it?
Well, as you know, there is a significant difference in how the U.S. legal system and the European Union legal system approaches privacy. In the EU, we have much more regulated approach. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., it's much more laissez-faire. There are several legislation, but nothing comparable in terms of bread to the European Directive Unions of Privacy. So, yes, there are some legislation, but many of the things that companies are doing with data are not illegal. They can do them. What is acting as a restraint is sometimes the norms of society, meaning that, for instance, it is already technologically feasible to provide advertising on as a pop-up window on your browser, which has your name in it. That's doable. Companies are not yet doing it, not because it's illegal, but because probably they would trigger consumer concern or even annoyance if they did so. To me, the question in the long run is whether these norms of society, which in a way currently are somewhat protecting us, will resist under the continuous impact of new privacy invasions, as well as new trends towards more personal information revelation online. Think about, you know, Facebook, MySpace, this continuous trend of revealing more and more about ourselves. In the long run, the question is, as a society, are we becoming less and less concerned about privacy, or vice versa? These continuous invasions eventually will trigger a certain point in which people become, okay, enough is enough.
But are people willing to trade the convenience for the privacy, Danny?
You know, I'd like to be perhaps overly optimistic and suggest that maybe we don't have to make that trade. We don't have to trade off all these exciting services that we have on the web for a sense of privacy. I think that if you look at what people are concerned about, whether it's access to your passport data or inappropriate use of, say, your Facebook profile, I think what people worry about for the most part is improper use of personal information. I think that Alessandro is correct that we're getting used to a situation, we're getting accustomed to a situation where a lot more people know a lot more about us. But in many ways, what privacy has always been about historically has been making sure that the knowledge that we have about individuals isn't abused, that it's not used to discriminate against us, that it's not used to make institutions, whether governments or others, too powerful. And so I would like to think that we can have our cake and eat it, too, to a large extent. If we can agree on what those norms are that Alessandro mentioned, Facebook's a great example. You know, what my students, I think, worry about are things like, someone puts a picture up of them at maybe a party that got a little bit out of hand the night before, and then they show up at a job interview the next day, and the employer is looking at a picture of them in a somewhat compromising situation. Well, we have two choices there. We could say, well, you can't put pictures on Facebook, or you have to get someone's permission to attach their name to a picture that you've taken. Or what we could do is evolve towards a point where we have social norms and perhaps even laws that say that you can't use a picture of a person, you can't use personal information like that to make a decision about someone's employment. And in many ways, I think that if you look at the world offline, we do that today. We are able to draw these kind of boundaries. In many cases, they're almost social niceties that we know, you know, you may be able to look in someone's briefcase or pocketbook, but you don't tend to just walk over and do that. And I think that one of the things we need on the web is a way to reintroduce those kinds of more subtle social norms.
We're talking. Let me just get a station ID in here. We're talking about security this hour on the internet on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Yes, Alessandro, go ahead.
I think Daniel made two really great points, and I wanted to remark something about. First of all, the value of information for an economist can only be known ex post. What I mean is that a certain piece of data about you assumes value depending on the context in which you are using. And this is the difficulty we have in handling our personal information. Because the photo of yourself in a beach in Cancun on a Facebook drinking rum and maybe pass out on the beach, when you use it on Facebook and you intend it to be to your peers, to your classmates, and so on and so forth, then it has a certain meaning. It carries a certain signal. However, it could also be used, as Daniel was mentioning, by your employer. In that moment, it assumes a completely different signal. So the value of information cannot be predicted in advance. It depends on how it will be used. And this is related to the challenge we have of transferring our ability to understand what is private and public in the offline world, in face-to-face interaction, transfer this into the online world, in which these calculations about how certain information will be used later on in time become much more difficult. Because how do you know whether a photo you post now 20 years from now will pop up when you are, say, a Supreme Court candidate and somebody will use it against you.
Mm-hmm. But some of these, these conveniences we have, I'm thinking like Gmail, for example. Don't you have a sort of make a bargain with Gmail? Gmail will give you free mail, but they're able to go through your mail to see where to send advertisers?
Ira, the bargain is really an interesting one because it's a bargain that actually has some of the kinds of usage limitations that we've been talking about implicit in it. Yes, there's quite extensive profiling that goes on associated with Gmail. Yes, Google keeps data about you for a period of time in order to do that profiling. But there's also some limitations that Google implicitly accepts, and I think people are aware of. Google doesn't sell that data, as far as we know, to others to market for other purposes or to contact you for other purposes. So Google, whether it's the right deal or not for everyone is certainly a question. But I think we have in a lot of these, even in these marketing environments, sort of some implicit boundaries that are really worth preserving and maintaining.
Alessandro, you get last word today.
Well, this extrapolating from the Gmail case, we have to realize that we make these kind of decisions daily, almost every minute, even if we know it or not, because information keeps being disseminated. And there have been studies, ESCMU and other places, about this dichotomy between what people say they would do in a certain scenario related to their privacy and what they actually end up doing. People care about privacy. If you ask about, they always rank privacy as one of the largest concerns, but then in terms of action, often we give out information even from small rewards, or we do not use the technologies which are privacy enhancing, such as those that Daniels and his colleagues at MIT or people here at CMU have developed. They end up not being used, which is a concern and is also something that we are trying to study, this dichotomy between attitudes and behavior.
Stay with us, gentlemen, would you? We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we've talked a lot about Facebook, so we're going to actually bring on an expert on Facebook who's written a book about Facebook, and will tell us a lot about it. She's Emily Vanderveer, author of The Missing Facebook, The Missing Manual. It's just out by O'Reilly's Pogue Press. So we're going to take a short break, switch a little bit to talk about Facebook, take more questions about computers and privacy with Alessandro Acquisti and Danny Weisner. And your questions are number 1-800-989-8255. Also in Second Life, find Science Friday's Island there and approach our avatar and ask a question. We'll try to get it on the air for you. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short message. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about privacy on the Internet with my guests, Danny Weitzner of the World Wide Web Consortium, Alessandro Acquisti of Carnegie Mellon University. And I want to also bring on someone who was an expert on Facebook. Now, Science Friday has a site on Facebook called Science Friday, the best day of the week. And, of course, if you know what Facebook is, it's a social networking site, and it's a really incredibly popular one. Facebook claims to have over 69 million active users with an average of 250,000 new registrations per day. But as we talked about before, just how private are those photos of your dog or worse, of your office party that you post on your profile? And joining me now to talk about it is Emily Vanderveer. She is author of Facebook, The Missing Manual, just out from O'Reilly's Pogue Press. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Is it possible to use Facebook and still be private?
The short answer is no.
Thank you very much. Well, people go, so they're making a social bond, right? Do people understand how public they are going to be when they're on Facebook?
You know, I don't believe that they do. And I think one of the things that really surprised me when I started researching this book was so many people didn't understand. A part of that, I think, is due to the Facebook people. They come out and they say up front, you know, it's private, it's secure. They really promote that idea that you're in this big room with all your friends, and what goes on in Facebook stays there. But, of course, that's not quite the whole story.
But aren't there lots of little switches and toggles in there that you can adjust what everybody gets to see?
There are, and this week Facebook announced a few more. Unfortunately, according to Facebook, only one out of four people can find those little toggles and then actually goes and toggles them. And
wow.
The difference, what they added this week was they made it a little more complex.
More complex?
Well, no, more, how do we put it? You can do more with it, with the feature.
The power user. The power user will like it. But for most of us, we don't know it's there, and we probably don't take the time to even look for it.
No, it's administrative stuff. People get on Facebook to do fun stuff. That's like going online and having somebody say, well, now go do your taxes before you can have any fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's get into some of the stuff that you're talking about. This week, Facebook unveiled some changes that let you restrict what you share to different sets of friends, right? Before, you had just one friend. Everybody's your friend. And now we have different sets of friends. You can group people into, for instance, friends from work or friends from college and only let each one see certain things. Is that what you're talking about?
That is exactly what I'm talking about. They always, or at least for a long time, they've had that capability. This is just an expansion of that capability. And, of course, the problem with that is of the one out of four people who's actually going to do it, it's a little bit more complex now. And, of course, now you have to decide, well, is this my work buddy? You know, I have beer with him after work, too. What group do I put him in? Mm. And, of course, when you get more friends, you have to go remember to stick them in the group. So.
Yeah. Now, Alessandra, I know you study Facebook also. What is your reaction to it?
I actually agree with Emily. In studies we did in publishing 2005 and in 2006, we did find out that at the time, the users we sampled had misconceptions about the visibility of their profiles. They thought that the profile was accessible by X people, while in fact we knew, because we could check, it was accessible by an order of magnitude larger amount of people. Mm-hmm. Also, there is what economists call the curse of options. When you give too many options to individuals, they tend to make a suboptimal choice, which means that control on your setting is a good thing. However, too granular control can end up being a boomerang, because it can end up overtaking the ability of the user to really control his or her privacy. So, yes, control is good, but don't put all the responsibility of the user, because it is also an important issue what is the default setting of those controls. Yeah. Our studies show that consumers, as well as individuals on Facebook, tend to maintain the default settings.
Mm-hmm. So Emily, then, would the rule be, if you don't want people to see it, don't post it?
Absolutely, and that's one thing that I start off the book saying. There's no such thing. If you put anything on the Internet, period, you've lost control over it. And I think Facebook does an admirable job of giving you guidance. You can guide the site on who you would like to see the information go to or not, but it's not secure. And even in the terms of use of Facebook, they come out and say that they're not responsible if it all goes missing. So.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
Well, you know, so I think that that's certainly sound advice if you want to be cautious, and some people will want to be cautious, and some people have really sensitive information that I'm sure they don't want exposed. So there's no question people have to be aware of the risks that they face today on these kinds of in these kinds of environments. I think, though, that we should really aspire to do somewhat better than this, because if you try to map this discussion that we're having about people needing to protect themselves, and you really can't expect anything's private, mm-hmm. Into other parts of our life, say our academic records at school, or our banking records, or our health records, you know, we'd all be in a state of utter paralysis. None of us would do anything if we all felt that we were at risk of total exposure at every moment. And I think that while I agree that it's great that Facebook is experimenting with these extra options, I think that it's really true what Alessandra said, that over and over again what we see with computer software in general is that people don't change their defaults. And I think we've really put the burden in the wrong place when it comes to privacy protection. We've expected that if people don't take active steps to protect their personal information, it must mean anyone can do anything with it. And I think that that's just the wrong assumption to make. It's not the assumption, I think, at the end of the day, that other users ought to make. It's just to be sort of, it's not polite. And I think ultimately there ought to be legal protections that establish some kind of boundaries that people can rely on without having to, guard all of their personal data by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John in Phoenix. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. My question is anyone concerned with the idea that by having this younger generation that I'm actually a part of, that are using the MySpaces and the Facebooks and have been posting personal information since they were 13, do you think that's going to breed a younger generation or going to breed a generation of people less concerned with their own personal security and all their information being out there because they've been doing it for so long?
I think it's really interesting. The older generation is, I think, jumping on the behavior patterns of the younger generation and trying to draw a lot of conclusions, many of which I actually think are inaccurate. There have been some very good studies by the Pew Center on Internet Life, which does a lot of polling on the way that people use, for example, the web and social networks. And what they find is that people actually do have pretty subtle expectations. They don't want all the data that they put on a social network to be exposed for use in any way by anyone. Mm-hmm. I think Emily's, I'm sure, right that they may have misconceptions about what the rules actually are. But I don't think that we should assume that just because people live somewhat more public lives that it's okay to do anything at all with their personal information.
So you think that Facebook needs to step up to the plate here and take more responsibility for the information that we give them?
I think that Facebook should. I think that it's actually a larger problem. I think that we as a society really have to come to some agreements about things like use of this sort of information in employment context, used in financial context, use where it's really sensitive, where it can really hurt us. And yes, I think we have to invest more, both in, on the legal side. I think the good news is that there are organizations like the National Science Foundation that are starting to fund a lot of research into this area to understand all the different dimensions of privacy, both the technical dimensions and the legal and sociological dimensions. So we have to just pay more attention to this. I think we'll learn a lot from what Facebook does, and I think they clearly have an interest in getting this right. I don't think they're going to be able to do it all by themselves.
Emily, what caution should people who get messages from people in Facebook and say, hey, poke me or send me an email or something, if you return those invitations, do you open yourself up?
You do. If somebody pokes you or sends you an email message or otherwise approaches you and you respond, you've just given them access to your profile, even though they might otherwise, even if you are one of those 1 out of 4 people that blocked them before. What you do in the case of somebody stalking, Facebook's got little links that you can go and report somebody, and of course they can get kicked off the site. But you do have to expect that.
Should you expect that if you close up your site, that Facebook will not keep the information?
I think you should expect that they will keep the information. And there was a big stink about this in the press a couple of weeks ago, and people were saying, wow, we can't get off the site. They're going to archive information. But, my response to that is this site is not free. You don't pay for it with money. You pay for it with your personal information. And they're using this. This is not society. This is a company that intends to make money off of it. They have no motivation to leave to delete your information. And there's no vetting process to find out whether or not they do or not. Mm-hmm. So I think that you need to go into there thinking, I'm going to use this site for a specific reason. I'm going to give just as much information as I'm okay with going out in the ether and then call it.
Mm-hmm. Alessandro, it seems that people either don't care or they're willing to make a little deal about the privacy they're willing to give up.
I would subscribe. I would prefer the second statement rather than the first, meaning that, yes, it is true. people make these kind of deals. I don't believe, however, that that can be taken to mean that people don't care about privacy. I feel that the reality is more complex, and I feel that there are lots of different forces in each of us which are pushing in different directions. All of us have a need to be public and to be recognized and to be known, and social networks like Facebook or MySpace satisfy that purpose. But the same people who are posting about themselves also have a need to be private. And it's very complex. And to give you a sense of the complexity, some of the studies we have done at CMU show that when you, in experimental conditions, when you present information versus money trade-off to people, depending on how you frame the question, whether you frame it as would you protect your data for X money versus would you sell your data for X money, people will make completely different decisions. So this means that there is an ability to manipulate valuations of privacy, but that does not mean that people don't care. Mm. It means that it's a very sensitive area in which different forces are at play. And also for policy making, we need to try to understand which these forces are.
Mm. Talking about privacy this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, let's see if we can get a phone call in here. Let's go to Kevin in Cape Cod. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon, Ira. I have two brief comments and a question. First, I tried three times to freeze my credit with the three data miners, and it was refused because it wasn't required by state law. Secondly, a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court in Conlon versus Reno basically affirmed that personal data is subject to regulation as interstate commerce product. So my question is, what rights do I really have? And I'll take my answer off there.
Thank All right. You. Thanks for calling.
Well, I hate to use I hate to use the word complicated again, but it's complicated. There's certainly, as far as I know, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or anywhere else, people do certainly have a lot of rights with respect to the way that credit bureaus handle their personal information. I don't know what the gentleman exactly was trying to do. Yes, of course. I think what we've been saying in this hour is that personal information is more and more an article of commerce. It affects the economy in really significant ways. But the question of what rights you actually have really depends, especially in the United States, depending on whether it's financial information or health information. It depends whether it's information that the government holds. We're talking about bargaining power that people have before. We should be especially aware of situations in which people don't have any bargaining power. I don't have any bargaining power with the United States government when they decide whether or not to read my email or look at data about me in a passenger list to figure out whether I'm a terrorist. That's where we really need legal protections to step in here, and they're sorely lacking.
1-800-989-8255. Where do we get what the State Department has? I mean, so, you know, that automatic system that said, somebody's looking at stuff that they shouldn't be looking at.
Well, you know, banks have those kinds of systems. Insurance companies have those kinds of systems. I think they could be beefed up in many ways. There's a lot of interesting work to do in that area to learn how to do that kind of detection of misuse better. That's some of the research that we do in my lab. But there's an underlying legal question there as well. Who has the right to have access to those checking or auditing procedures? Senator Obama is a pretty well-known guy, so when something goes wrong with respect to him, everyone jumps. As I think you said before, it's a much bigger question.
Yeah.
Who's going to protect just any old person? And I think that we need rules to give people more rights to make sure that the information that's held about them is accurate and used fairly.
Emily, on Facebook, any overriding thing that we should do if we're a member of Facebook, a switch we should throw, something that you would suggest?
I would suggest two things right off the bat, and one of them is to decide why it is you're on the site in the first place. I think a lot of people get on there and they don't know why. Maybe somebody gave them an invitation, and then they pour out all this personal information, and then they decide, well, you know, this isn't really useful. If you have a very specific reason, and there are a lot of good reasons to use the site, you can get on there to, you know, find a job, to keep in touch with people that you're already getting in touch with, work friends, dating, whatever it is. Decide what it is, and that's going to inform what kind of information and how much you give the site. Just give as much as you need to get what accomplished you want to get accomplished on the site, and then never, ever, ever stick anything up there that you just absolutely don't want. You know, like I'm, you know, in a witness protection program or something just really, really that could bite you. Don't put it up.
Mm-hmm. Could I just add, Ira, that sure. one of the kind of real conundrums about Facebook is Emily's absolutely right on the one hand that people should know what they're doing there and think about what they expose. But a really interesting phenomenon of all these social networks is that our privacy, the amount of privacy that we lose in many ways is determined by what other people do, what other people say about us, how other people tag photos. We're not in total control. There's no way that any individual can be in complete control of their privacy situation. And again, that's why we need these kind of broader social norms. To
Alessandro, quick comment?
Yeah.
I got about 10 seconds.
Well, Daniel makes a great point. And indeed, what is remarkable now is that it is possible to identify people even starting from anonymous information, meaning you can collect different traces of data, none of them really revealing your personal identity, but doing statistical analysis, you can reconnect them together and expose an individual identity, which makes the problem even more difficult to handle for the individual person.
Well, I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Alessandro Chisti, who is an assistant professor of information technology and public policy at Carnegie Mellon, co-editor of the book Digital Privacy, Theory, Technologies, and Practices. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Daniel Weissner, co-director of the MIT C-Scale Decentralized Information Group. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much.
And Emily Van Devere, author of Facebook, The Missing Manual, out from Pogue Press. It's an interesting read. I highly recommend it. Thank you, Emily.
It was a pleasure.
For being with us today. That's about all the time we have today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, and we're podcasting and blogging, and hope you all will join us next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.